In the coming week, the world reacts to the grim report from the UN's panel on climate change. Taliban forces surge across Afghanistan as the U.S. finalizes its withdrawal, and Ethiopia's civil war worsens. It's August 12, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, we don't often lead off by talking about a 4,000-page report on anything, but I think this week is a notable exception. That's the length of the report released by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, otherwise known as the IPCC. Now, this is a panel of about 200 or more leading climate scientists from around the world, and they research and put together this report every several years. Tell us, Jim, what are some of the takeaways we need to know about the latest, the sixth assessment report?
Let's begin with the headline, Bob, which I would summarize as it's worse than you thought, and it's getting worse faster than you thought. As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres put it, the report is a code red for humanity. Main findings are, one, the planet is warming at a rate not seen in recorded history, and that temperature increase is being driven by the burning of fossil fuels. The levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, their highest in 2 million years, and the warming globe is the reason why we are seeing so many extreme weather events. Now, what is most significant, I think, in the report is that it concluded that the odds of keeping the increase in the global average temperature to under 2 degrees Celsius are dimming. Indeed, the report concluded that we are likely to see a 1.5 degree Celsius increase by 2040, even if we stopped all emissions today. Now, that's significant because 2 degrees Celsius is seen as a tipping point to a climate catastrophe, in which we would see massive rises in sea level, the death of ocean reefs, and the possible collapse of the aquatic food chain. The report's conclusion is that countries aren't doing enough to address the challenge posed by climate change. The report says that what is required is, and let me quote it, an unprecedented transformational change. Now, of course, the big issue is what to do about it, and there are no shortage of policy initiatives to discourage the use of fossil fuels and to encourage the shift to renewable energy. Something I suspect you're going to be hearing more about in the months to come is carbon border adjustment taxes. That's where countries impose special duties or taxes on imports that generate a lot of carbon dioxide emissions. The idea is that this will force producing countries to adopt cleaner energy methods. The European Union right now is considering adopting just such a carbon border adjustment tax, and one of the big targets will be China, which produces a lot of energy-intensive products like cement and steel, and it uses methods that are heavily carbon-intensive, relying heavily on the use of coal-fired power plants. Likewise, I think we're going to hear more about technological solutions, whether those are about finding ways to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere or reflecting sunlight back into space. Now, I have to say, Bob, after sort of reading parts of the report and reading the news coverage, it's hard not to come away being pretty skeptical that we're going to meet the challenge. First, when we talk about technological solutions, yes, some of them are simple. You could probably make a big dent in carbon by reforesting parts of the earth, that is, planting trees and the like. But a lot of the technological solutions people are talking about are still on the drawing boards, and they have to be made effective on a planetary scale. But the bigger issue is, and we've talked about this many times before, the inability to translate pledges into policy. And I'll give you one example that I think really sort of highlights, and it comes from this week. Joe Biden has said that climate change is an existential threat to the United States, but this week he also did two things. One, he said he was opposed to any increase in the gasoline tax. Obviously, one benefit of increasing the tax on gasoline here in the United States would make it more expensive to drive. It presumably would alter people's calculations about how much they do drive. Second thing is the Biden administration urged OPEC to produce more oil to help stimulate the economic recovery from the pandemic. Now, I'm not trying to single out Joe Biden for saying one thing and doing another, but simply to highlight how politically difficult it is to make even relatively small changes when it comes to the burning of fossil fuels. And again, this is not just a failure in the United States, but a failure across the world.
Jim, so you touched on the political third rail issue that's relevant for any U.S. administration, Republican or Democrat, which is you try to keep gas prices low. Gas prices, even for an administration that has has avowed it's going to move towards renewables, it's going to move towards electric cars and so forth. There has been heightened politicking around this issue, obviously, for Republicans seeing it as an issue they can seize on and already campaigning for the midterm elections next year, see it as a great win area for them. Obviously, we have not seen a great sort of change in attitude among climate change or human-caused climate change skeptics, especially among Republicans since the report came out. We also haven't seen China say, oh, you know what, we're going to change our fossil fuel strategy and curtail all coal usage next year, or I'm being dramatic, but you haven't seen countries that are contributing to this problem make any sort of about face. You mentioned, obviously, the U.S. could have a great deal of influence sort of using its stature internationally, but won't. And then you have other countries that are going to take care of their country's self-interest. And it just remains to be seen whether extreme climate events will be so pronounced that they might start turning the tables, Jim. For me, I still remain convinced that what still seems to be a kind of an inexorable change towards renewables is going to be something that changes the calculus eventually, but certainly nothing dramatic.
Well, the problem, Bob, is that we may see a long-term shift to renewables, but that doesn't mean it will happen at a fast enough pace to avoid getting the catastrophic outcomes that the IPCC's report has warned us about. And again, just step back, think about this. The report says that even if we did everything right starting today, there is so much momentum built up in the energy system that we're going to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius as an increase by 2040. That's a little over 18 years away from where we are right now. That's a frightening thought. And again, it raises a couple of issues. One is that as the Earth heats up, as we see more extreme weather events, the costs are going to be immense. We're already seeing those costs. We're seeing them in the wildfires in Australia, in the Western United States, in places like Greece and Turkey. We're seeing it in the collapse of farming in various parts of the country. Places where you grew one crop now all of a sudden can't sustain it. That leads to migration. That leads to further conflict. We're seeing it in sea rise. I mean, if we get to this point of 2 degrees Celsius in terms of an increase, you're talking about probably an irreversible change in the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. That means sea levels are going to rise. Well, if you live in low-lying places, that is catastrophic. It's not just things that will happen overseas. Yes, a lot of people like to talk about rising sea levels inundating small islands in the Pacific, or talking about how there's a potential that in 30 years, a country like Vietnam with a population of more than 100 million could see 80 to 90% of its territory overcome with ocean water at some point during a year. It also matters here at home. The state of Florida, highest point's 117 feet above sea level. Sea levels rise, big parts of Florida are going to be underwater. And trying to adapt to that is going to be incredibly expensive. I'm reminded of that old Ram oil filter commercial about pay me now or pay me later. And I think down the road, the price tag is going to be very, very high.
Yeah. And, we talked previously in the podcast about the phenomenon of the heat domes and what it did in the Pacific Northwest and Canada. We're actually enduring a kind of a mini heat dome as we speak right now in this part of the country, Jim, where we're taping this podcast in the mid-Atlantic states. And those kinds of things are, by all accounts, going to be more common. We also just came through a year in which we had the opportunity, because of COVID, to have like a mini experiment to see what happens when you slow down the emission of fossil fuels, or you have much fewer, jet plane flights and so forth. And as this report indicated, and as other reports have shown, it had barely a limiting effect on the buildup of carbon emissions and what it has done towards forcing extreme weather events, which is a very complicated calculus, but it does seem to be all moving in this direction. And yet you cannot get anything close to the consensus needed for the actions needed, Jim. So it is going to be, I think, a rush to respond sometimes after the fact to some of these extreme developments, whether it's flooding or wildfires or whatever. It's hard not to be just really depressed. I can't be that way because I have kids I'm trying to show path to the future, but it's pretty difficult.
It certainly is, Bob. And I do think that we have a big meeting coming up in Glasgow in November, so-called COP26 Conference of Parties, in which all of the major emitters are going to be around the table. And the question is going to be, are they going to produce plans, credible plans, to move much more rapidly on curtailing the emission of heat trapping gases? So I think there's going to be a lot of attention on Glasgow. And again, my fear is that Glasgow will be like so many of these other meetings where people come with big plans, but those plans never seem to come into reality. Bob, let's turn our attention to Afghanistan, where the news seems to be equally grim. The United States is in the final stages of its complete withdrawal of combat forces from Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the Taliban have been securing military victory after military victory across the country, seizing control of, I think now, at least 10 provincial capitals, including one that is about 80 miles from the national capital of Kabul. Are we looking at a Taliban takeover of the entire country, Bob?
Jim, I should first say that as we're taping this, I'm well aware that some of the things we're going to say could be overtaken because things seem to be moving much more quickly than anybody expected in Afghanistan. We are, by all accounts, looking at a swift takeover of the country. But I would put a few caveats in. Among a number of experts have pointed out that seizing provincial capitals is not the same as seizing provinces. In some cases, these capitals or places where the central government had asserted control amounted to outposts with maybe a few hundred personnel and then little control over the rest of the district. And by little control, I mean little control by anyone, government or Taliban forces. But by seizing these capitals, by seizing border posts and doing it in such a way that seems to be very methodical and very strategic, the Taliban look very much prepared to take over all the crucial sort of choke points, infrastructure, and so forth that would allow them to then eventually move on the capital. There were some estimates that said the U.S. security officials had revised their estimates of when Kabul could fall, maybe within 90 days. It sure seems like it could be a lot quicker than that, Jim, depending on what the Taliban might be prepared to do. I was struck by a report in today's Washington Post about how the seizure of a base in Kunduz came about. Now, there was an entire Afghan army corps there, about 2,000 Afghan troops, and they surrendered after relatively small amount of fighting, if any. The reports from Kunduz indicated that while some of them were captured under an agreement to not fight anymore, a number of them just took off their uniforms and sort of melted into the countryside in civilian clothes and left everything else there. This is an army corps. There's only, I believe, 7 of them in the entire country. And this is in the north, which used to be a stronghold of resistance to the Taliban in the pre-9/11 period when the Taliban controlled most of the country. So you have now Taliban showing strength and the Afghan government forces showing a weakness that I think were both underestimated. And it really is a kind of new territory for us all. You also have an effort going on in sort of what seems to be some last-ditch effort by U.S. and other diplomats to try to sort of press the Taliban back to the peace table that seemed to be very, very ineffectual. And so it is looking like, Jim, that facts on the ground are going to tell the tale in Afghanistan, that you are going to see the Taliban move into power. But we should warn that a number of things could still change. There is still time, as some point out, for the U.S. to decide to reinforce an air campaign that could still be effective against the Taliban forces. By all appearances and by all comments so far from the Biden administration, there's little interest in doing that right now. But you have a situation in which places in which Afghan government forces have held are now folding. You have displaced people fleeing into Kabul, refugees starting to flee across the border into Pakistan, already seeing interest in seeking flight as far away as Europe and so forth. It is looking bad and about to get worse, Jim.
Bob, I take your point that the Afghan army is collapsing. I should note that when you have instances such as you mentioned where a whole army corps simply quits the field, that makes the Taliban even stronger because they seize all the weapons that are left behind, almost all of which have been provided to the Afghan army by the U.S. government. I want to go back to this broader question, an issue that I keep hearing about, that people are surprised with how rapidly the Afghan army has collapsed. Why are people surprised, Bob? It doesn't strike me as surprising at all. I mean, there's a long history of governments collapsing rapidly. We had heard for many years about how ineffectual U.S. training had been. We know from history how difficult it is to build up another country's army. So why do we have so many people going on cable news networks saying they're just surprised that the U.S. departure has led to this very quick surge by the Taliban?
Yeah, Jim, I think it speaks to the relative inattention to Afghanistan. Yes, it's been getting a lot of attention, especially in the last couple of years since the U.S. has clearly signaled it's interested in a drawdown and then in a peace agreement with the Taliban. But the inattention to what this really involves, what capacity the Afghan government really has, I think there's been a lot of reports reporting about how the U.S. military has been kind of distorting the gains in the field. It's been distorting the way information has come out of Afghanistan about the extent to which its efforts have made a difference, the extent to which the central government has writ outside of Kabul or some district centers. So you had this general sense potentially of complacency, and if not complacency, then just inattention to just what the dynamic is involving the Taliban. I mean, this is a force that's never gone away. I mean, it was defeated soundly after the 9/11 attacks and routed, and then it reconstituted itself. And by it, I mean a command structure of Pashtuns, and there are enormous amount of ethnic Pashtuns on both Afghan and Pakistan sides of the border, so much so that some people say a border doesn't really exist. It's just sort of a nominal line in which these groups that are ethnically linked cross when they want to. And so the force has always been there. It's fought against the largest, most powerful military alliance in the world for two decades now, and has not been defeated, really. It's been sort of pushed into hiding, but at the end of the day, the nation-building efforts in Afghanistan have not succeeded the way people hoped they would. And yet the information out of there, and this is, I think this big thing I would come back to, Jim, is that it was either distorted or misinterpreted or just not, there was inattention to what was really happening, what has been really happening in Afghanistan. And I say this as someone who still thinks there might be some way to push back against the Taliban, but is also seeing an inevitability here play out. And I would just note that the calls that came out of Doha this week, and our colleague Max Boot wrote about this in the Washington Post today in the op-ed section, the calls about, you know, sort of warning the Taliban that it's going to be isolated diplomatically really seem to be incredibly tone deaf, especially given the history of the Taliban, especially going back to the pre-9/11 period when there was no more isolated group regime in the world. And yet it still allowed al-Qaeda to base itself there and to launch the attacks and ended up leading to the group's ouster.
That gets to an argument that's been made by a number of experts who were skeptical of the continued American presence in Afghanistan. And their argument, as I understand it, was that if the United States left, the Taliban would be unlikely to come to power because outside powers would have an interest in making sure that didn't happen. And they would use the threat of withholding international aid to basically compel the Taliban to limit its ambitions. I should note that while the Taliban has surged across the country, it doesn't control the entire country. It doesn't yet control Kabul, but certainly the trajectory is quite alarming. And there hasn't been any evidence thus far that those calculations that outsiders had, that the Taliban would worry about missing out on international aid, that would in fact deter them from their plans. I mean, there's no sense, at least from what I can tell, that the Taliban are looking at the events of the last several weeks and saying, now is the time to stop. It seems that what they believe is the momentum is with them and that they're going to push on. And the question is, what is going to happen at that point? They may sort of control most of the country, perhaps not Kabul. But the real question is going to be, what happens on the human rights front? Are we going to see the loss of the many gains that happened over the last two decades? Are we going to see an acceleration of the production and export of opium? Are we going to see the Taliban permit groups like al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, to operate in their territory? I think there are a bunch of very big questions here on these issues.
Yeah, that last point in particular, Jim, is one that I think will cause the greatest amount of response internationally, and that's whether it's the U.S. or other, you know, regional powers who have a stake there. I mean, one of the things that's coming out of the meetings in Doha right now, where you have all the major neighboring countries except for Iran and all the major regional powers in attendance, so that's Russia, China, Pakistan, U.S., EU, and there have already been reports of Russian and Chinese contacts with Taliban. They are certainly no friends, but they are also pragmatic, it seems, and are looking to try to make sure that there's some sort of stabilized presence in Afghanistan. I'm not sure how possible that's going to be, frankly. There's many scenarios that could erupt, right, Jim? One thing I didn't mention was that Afghanistan still has lots of clan leaders, and these are people who actually ended up allying with the U.S.-led forces when the Taliban was initially ousted and held sway over certain regions of the country and kind of kept them under control, shall we say, for a while. They are all heavily armed. They could mount an effective counter-Taliban resistance, and you could see Afghanistan devolve into civil war, which it's very familiar with going back decades. You could see sort of a Yemen-type situation where there's proxy battles going on, some forces supported by some outside powers and others by other powers. So it's a great deal of misery, unfortunately. And you mentioned the gains Afghanistan made. It is worth saying that there have been gains, despite the problems and the enormous amount of money and blood spilled in the country. We're going to be putting out a piece in the coming week showing graphically sort of what the trajectory of Afghanistan over the last 20 years, and certainly in the case of, say, women and girls' education or political freedoms, despite its problems, political freedoms, media freedoms, that the country has made some clear advances. But on the security realm in particular, it has not. And even in the area of opium, there's been sort of a steady level of opium production that continues. And that continued through all the vast nation building efforts that went on, because it's a subsistence crop for a number of Afghan farmers. And one would expect the Taliban to take advantage of that like it did previously as a source of revenue.
Well, I suspect that Afghanistan's future is going to be even grimmer than its present.
Well, Jim, I'm going to turn our attention to another theater of fighting where the prospects are also grim, and that is in Ethiopia. There is an ongoing and by many accounts worsening civil war there. It is getting an increased amount of international attention. You've had Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussing the war just recently with the Sudanese Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok, and they had pressed for a ceasefire in the region. There have been calls from the UN Security Council for such, yet many of these calls coming from the region, coming from international bodies, are sort of reaching deaf ears. There is a process underway that seems to be, you know, achieving its own force right now, and you have this region in the north, Tigray, with forces that are gathering speed and pressing against the rest of Ethiopia. So, Jim, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what's to expect next?
Well, Bob, I think you've summarized the situation accurately. Fighting is intensifying and mediation efforts are stumbling. Just this past week, Sudan recalled its ambassador from Addis Ababa after Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed dismissed Sudan's offer to help mediate the conflict. Maybe we should just sort of step back and put all of this in context. You may recall that last November, Abiy ordered the Ethiopian army into the northern Ethiopian province of Tigray in response to what he said was an attack by Tigrayan rebels on a government base there. Now, Ethiopia has a population of about 110 million, consisting of more than 90 different ethnic groups. Tigrayans constitute about 5% of the country's population, but they have, over the last half century, had an outsized influence on Ethiopian politics. Back in 1991, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, led the ouster of the ruling military regime, and they ended up dominating Ethiopia's politics for the next 25 plus years. Now, Abiy eased the TPLF out in 2018, and you have to keep in mind that Abiy is a member of Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, the Oromo, and they constitute about a third of the population. Now, the fighting has not gone the way Abiy and his government had hoped. Rather than crushing the TPLF, the reverse has happened. In June, TPLF forces recaptured the Tigrayan capital of Mekelle, and since then, the TPLF forces have pushed the Ethiopian military out of Tigray, and they've gone on to seize territory in the neighboring regions of Amhara and Afar. The latter is significant because the TPLF is poised to seize control of the roads and railways from Djibouti. And that is the source of some 95% of the country's trade. So the big question experts are grappling with is, what will come next in the fighting? Is the TPLF going to be content to consolidate its existing gains, or is it going to press forward trying to topple Abiy's government? And while that gets debated, what is clear is that the war is having a devastating impact on civilians. Some 5.2 million Tigrayans face severe food shortages, and it is estimated that as many as 300,000 people in Amhara and Afar are experiencing emergency levels of hunger. And it gets worse. Amnesty International released a report yesterday accusing the Ethiopian military and related militias of using rape, sexual slavery, mutilation, and other atrocities against ethnic Tigrayan women and girls. And the problem is, if it's bad now, it could get worse in the coming weeks. Abiy just called on all capable Ethiopians who are of age to join the defense forces to show their patriotism. And many people are worried that if you begin mobilizing untrained troops and in essence have a societal war, that's going to lead to just greater bloodshed and more atrocities.
Yeah, Jim, and as we were taping this podcast, our colleague Michelle Gavin posted a blog about sort of the deepening problems there. She writes, quote, "All the trends are moving in the wrong direction. All the antagonists are making decisions that broaden conflict as they double down on pursuit of military solutions." So basically echoing what you just said. But she also points out that what seems to be a real dug-in attitude by the central government authorities in Ethiopia against outside parties, particularly the United States, for what they see as neo-colonial meddling and sort of pro-TPLF stances. So it just seems like there's little leverage that the outside community has, although it probably will have more as you get into a fully-fledged civil war that is creating a regional humanitarian crisis.
Well, Bob, as we have seen in Syria, it can be very difficult for outside outside parties to stop a civil war. I'm not saying Syria and Ethiopia are equivalent, just pointing out that civil wars have their own dynamic. The actors in a country have their own interests and incentives, their own fears about what is going to happen that can lead to just calamitous outcomes. Unfortunately, we're seeing it in Ethiopia.
Yeah, and that goes for the regional response as well. I mean, many countries in Africa have a lot at stake, and it wasn't that long ago we were talking about Ethiopia as being this hub, this pillar of East Africa, and a place where the continent was starting to put itself together, and in fact, the opposite's happening.
Well, what we're discovering, Bob, is peace and prosperity are difficult to build, and unfortunately, all too easy to break. But Bob, let's now turn to our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience is selected thousands cross Belarus. Why was this the choice, Bob?
Well, Jim, Belarus, as we've discussed previously, is another country going in the wrong direction. It was already known as the last dictatorship in Europe for a time. But since basically the last 365 days or so, since tainted Belarusian elections, I should say, were held, the Lukashenko regime that runs the country has been cracking down in all directions, such that you have publications like The Economist calling it a gangster state. And one of the ways it's doing that is turning against all who would sort of try to stand up for human rights reasons against the country. So neighboring Lithuania has proven itself a real pillar in support of human rights activists and especially Belarusian political opponents. And Belarus has responded by sort of weaponizing the migrant trade and especially the people smuggling trade. So it is unfortunately all too easy for traffickers to sort of respond to such a government's moves if they wish. And so what you have is this phenomenon in which thousands of people are transiting Belarus to cross into Lithuania through various promises made by smugglers and sort of pass-through provided by the Belarusian government. So the latest estimate I saw, Jim, was that more than 4,100 would-be migrants have passed into Lithuania from Belarus. 2,800 or so are from Iraq. So they were able to harness these people smuggling networks out of Iraq, and these people are now sort of residing in Lithuania. Now, Lithuania just got a boost from the EU in terms of setting up shelters and medical care and putting in place asylum procedures. But what it's really trying to do is sort of stop this flow and stop this sort of set of actions that Belarus is doing. There is increasingly less and less leverage. And this is echoing what we've been talking about already on the podcast, Jim, which is, you know, what do you do against a regime or a movement that is intent on, you know, sort of preserving its power and sort of fomenting chaos? And sanctioning Belarusian officials doesn't seem to be that effective. In fact, it's creating a backlash that is continuing to reverberate. You just had Belarus deny entry of a U.S. ambassador. It wouldn't be the first U.S. ambassador in Belarus since 2008. As a response to U.S. sanctions that were set, Lukashenko has spoken out harshly against EU efforts as well. So there's this doubling down going on. We had spoken previously in this podcast about the sort of hijacking of an international flight that contained a Belarusian activist so that it would land in Minsk. That took place. It was relatively, although a lot of strong words, relatively little by way of punitive action that seemingly took place after that, Jim. So you have this phenomenon of, again, people being trafficked across the country and weaponized in a way that would put pressure on a neighbor that has been seen as a haven for opposition figures in Belarus.
Bob, several years ago, our mutual boss, Richard Haass, wrote a book called A World in Disarray. After listening to this conversation, I see nothing to challenge Richard's diagnosis.
I think that captures it, Jim. I mean, you know, the phrase doom scrolling emerged in the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, but it's really taken hold in ways that transcend the pandemic, or maybe the pandemic has exacerbated some of the problems and some of the emotions. But there are things that were already percolating before the pandemic and that have just been escalated, I think, Jim. And this past Monday, in sort of catching up into the news cycle, I was immediately launched into my head the lyrics of a Beatles song. I read the news today, oh, boy. And that seems to be a daily thing.
It is, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. APEC holds its 2021 Food Security Ministers meeting virtually, and the anniversary of the 1953 Iranian coup is marked.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Leila Marhamati, and Michael Kohler for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.